We're very glad to be able to take a look at an issue that has some national importance, some economic importance, importance to you and your parents and grandparents. It's a program that's been in place in the United States, something as a way of providing some measure of economic security. When people reach the end of their careers, they're not making as big an income or any income anymore. People retire at age 65 or later, perhaps, or some people have to retire earlier if they're injured in their work. And decades ago, the United States government set up a program to be able to provide some financial underpinning to elder people who have retired. The system is known as Social Security. At least if it doesn't provide complete social security or economic security, it provides at least a measure of reliable income that's going to be there for people once they retire. And this has been coordinated through a government program. It's a way that we have of investing for the future, a way that people pay into with their salaries instead of or in addition to private investments, the 501k plans or other types of private investments where you can save for your retirement if you don't have private savings of your own. Not everyone can afford to set aside a huge amount of money, enough to sustain them for the rest of their lives. People, families with children especially, paying off college loans, paying medical bills perhaps out of pocket. And the Social Security project was created in order to be able to provide elder people this kind of security. Now, I know what I'm saying, if you're an elder person, is completely boring and you've heard all of this before, but a lot of younger people don't really know much about Social Security. It was created before we were born as a U.S. government program, and there's now a fast sales job going on and about to be ratcheted up over the course of the next few years of the Bush administration by Wall Street and by major investment banks and brokers, who stand to gain the most from a new scheme the Bush administration would propose to privatize the entire Social Security system. That is, to put under private investment banks' control the investment and use of billions of dollars of Social Security set-asides that were otherwise in very wisely, carefully, conservatively invested programs. I think it's interesting to be able to take a look at some of the what we might call advertising for this kind of program, which starts out by proposing the following thing: that the Social Security system, the entire multi-billion-dollar, multi-trillion-dollar system, is going bankrupt. And it's going to be bankrupt by 2010 or 2020. And if we don't start doing something different with it right now, none of us in the baby boomer generation or anyone who comes after us is going to have any money left in that system to be able to retire on. So I'm very glad to be able to welcome, with that long introduction, Ellen Frank. Welcome to the broadcast. And feel free to correct anything you said that I think was inaccurate or misrepresenting the situation. But let me ask you just about that claim, that to start with, before we even get into what should be done, the claim that Social Security is going bankrupt.
Well, let me actually correct a misrepresentation that you made a little earlier when you said that Social Security was invested in very conservative, da-da-da. Social Security isn't invested in anything, because Social Security is not an investment program. It's not a savings program. It's a transfer program. And, you know, young people do know about Social Security because every dollar you earn in wages is taxed at 6.4% or 6.2%, and your employer throws in another 6.2%. And so every dollar you earn, 12.4% is paid in Social Security taxes. And that's if you only earn $10, you know, at a coffee shop, you know, for 1 hour's work, you pay into the Social Security system. Every dollar is taxed, and that payroll tax goes into Social Security. And what happens to it after it goes into Social Security is that it is used to pay benefits to current retirees. So the people today, all elderly people, disabled people, people who are collecting Social Security benefits, also, I should also point out that the Social Security survivors' benefits are a really important source of income for a lot of families. A parent dies who's paid into the Social Security system, and the children are eligible until they finish college to receive a very generous benefit. And this system, the money that we are paying in when we work is being paid out in benefits. And that's how the system works. So that brings me to the question you asked, is the system going broke? And the answer is, well, how could it go broke? It's a transfer program. So what does it mean for a transfer program to go broke? What it means is that the public says, well, we're not going to take care of you anymore. So as long as American voters are willing to take care of the elderly and the disabled and the surviving children of people, you know, who have died and paid into the system, as long as we're willing to provide that kind of insurance against adversity and old age and disability, then we will provide it. And if we stop providing it, then that's a political decision. It has nothing to do with going broke.
I raised the point specifically about younger people not knowing so much about Social Security, partly because I think we haven't had as much lifetime experience to learn about it, mm-hmm. and we're a little bit more distant from needing it. And so it was interesting to notice the American Association of Retired Persons, largest organization of elder people in the United States, vociferously opposing the privatization of Social Security, at least among their membership, although it was interesting. Interesting to see their own, the top of their own leadership, beginning to make noises to support the privatization of Social Security, and that person beginning to show a sort of a different outlook about this idea than most of the membership. But I think it's something where the sort of target of the sales job that I propose is about to happen over the next 4 years in the Bush administration. The target market of that sales job are younger people who in 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s who are still paying into Social Security and still would, as the Bush administration like to say, exercise the choice to invest mm-hmm. Their money in a different way. It's all about liberty and the freedom to choose. George Bush says people should have the freedom to invest their money how they want to.
Right. Well, you know, I think that, of course, the selling job is going to be primarily directed to young people for a couple of reasons. One is that young people don't think about retirement. So, you know, I mean, when you're 25 years old or 22 years old, the idea that someday you're going to be 65 and have no income and have, you know, arthritis in your knees and, you know, these physical problems is not something you either do think about or want to think about. And when people do think about it, I think they're very unrealistic about what that means. The other reason is that young people are being encouraged to think of Social Security as being about them and about their retirement. But in fact, the real interest that young people have in Social Security today is who's going to care for their parents. And they should ask themselves when they think about, would I be better off with private accounts? If private accounts are added to Social Security, there's a huge transition cost. It means that the money that's going into these private accounts is no longer going into Social Security, and therefore it's no longer paying benefits. And therefore, your grandparents are going to be in trouble, and your parents 10 years from now when they retire are going to be in trouble. And you know who's going to have to take care of them? You are. And that's going to cost you money. And so that's, you know, that one of the really important things that Social Security did was it gave young people a great deal more freedom in the age at which they were raising their children and establishing their family, because they didn't have to care for elderly parents. The parents were taken care of through Social Security, and it was not until they became very old and frail and ill did they become a burden on their children, which is more usually in your 40s or 50s. Rather than in your 20s or 30s. So Social Security is really important to young people because it's a benefit that your parents collect, and if you're not paying into it, they're not collecting it. So you're going to have to take care of them and yourself. So one of the problems with private accounts is that young people who are being told that this is good for them are actually going to be asked to pay twice instead of just once. Instead of just paying into the system, they're going to be asked to pay for their parents and then to pay again for themselves, and nobody's going to pay for them. They're just going to get what they have when they retire in these private accounts. The other thing about young people is that people, when they're young, are unrealistic. You don't have a realistic sense about money or how much it costs to retire. If you look at these actual plans, what we're talking about is $1,000 a year put into private accounts, $1,000 a year over a working life of 40 years with, you know, average returns on stocks and bonds, you're going to retire with about $100,000. That isn't going to be enough to see you through, you know, 10 years of retirement, 20 years of retirement, possibly even 30 years of retirement. That's not going to be enough when you consider that Social Security benefits are going to, for young people, are going to be cut by more than 50% in order to pay for these private accounts. So it's a really bad deal for young people. And the question for me is, for whom is this a good deal? And the answer to that question is, it's a good deal for the zillions of financial firms that will manage all these little $1,000 accounts.
So these financial firms would be managing these individual accounts instead of the U.S. government managing the Social Security system, which, you're right, I incorrectly said was an investment. It's more of a transfer.
Well, I didn't mean to criticize you. It's just I think that people mistakenly think that, and the government mistakenly creates the impression that this is a pension plan, a financial plan, and therefore it can go broke. But when you realize that it's not really an investment plan or a pension plan, then you realize that it can't really go broke, that it's not even a possibility unless there's a political choice to disband it.
Well, let's talk about how that comes up. I just want to mention we're speaking with Ellen Frank, senior economist at the Poverty Institute at Rhode Island College in the studio. You're tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM. Because Ellen Frank, it's pointed out oftentimes that the baby boom generation is larger and greater number of people than the number of people currently retired, and so you have a larger number of people paying into a system to transfer to our system to support a smaller number of people. That's about to reverse, and the baby boom generation will be the larger group of retired people having to be supported by a smaller group of people paying into the system.
Right. Well, there are a couple of things to realize. The first thing is that it doesn't matter what Social Security does. That's going to be the case anyway. I mean, if Social Security doesn't take care of your parents, then you're going to have to take care of your parents. So they're going to be a burden one way or the other. And getting rid of Social Security or changing the financing of it doesn't make any difference. If people are going to be retired and not working, somebody's got to care for them. And that situation is irreversible. The only thing we can do to eliminate that problem is to kill people off or encourage them to work until they're 80s or something like that. And that's not going to happen because people can't. And it's actually a good thing for young people. When older people leave the labor market, it opens up jobs and positions and opportunities for them. So the burden of caring for this baby boom generation is a burden that exists, you know, regardless of how you finance it. But the other thing that I think is mistaken is that we tend to overemphasize what a burden this is going to be. They have all these people, you know, the people in the 50s had large families, you know, the children of that baby boom had small families, and their smaller families, their two or three children are going to have to care for all these, you know, retirees. But let's remember that those large families, the baby boomers who are going to be a large number of retirees, were once a large number of children. And they had to be taken care of. And they had to be taken care of in families where, for the most part, mothers didn't go out and work in the private sector workforce. So that baby boom generation was taken care of by a very, very small working population from the time they were born until the time they reached their 20s. And, in fact, we actually even encouraged them to continue to stay in college through graduate school. And so in many cases were taken care of and not working, contributing until their mid-20s.
So you're pointing out that
we didn't have a problem taking care of them then.
They're a lot bigger workforce now, mm-hmm. because a lot more of two income earning households.
We took care of them. A small population took care of that large baby boom population when they were young, and a small population is going to take care of them when they're old. The population that's going to take care of them when they're old is a much richer population than the population, the people who took care of them. The people in the 2004, we have a higher standard of living than we had in 1944 when the baby boom generation were born. So it's actually not that big of a problem as long as we're willing to make a commitment to take care of it. And I think that American society and American youth, when they understand that that's the issue isn't whether I can control my money, the issue is, are my parents and grandparents going to be cared for, and will my children and grandchildren care for me, and is that the kind of society I want to live in, that they will say, yes, it is. That is the kind of society I want to live in, that we have an obligation to, after people have worked 40 years, put 40 years of their life into the workforce, to take care of them and to allow them to have some relaxation and rest in their old age. And I think that most people would agree that's worth supporting.
Let me ask another question based on, I think, something where we're going to be hearing a lot more of, which is if Social Security remains a transfer system, like you say, a system where the money that a younger generation pays into it is transferred to what an older generation needs to be cared for, what about the argument that if that money is, instead of just being transferred, is invested, it will increase in the total amount of money available to pay out to Social Security recipients will be larger?
The amount of money, what happens to the amount of money is let's see how to put this. The transfer at a national level is irrelevant to the amount of money that people have or don't have. It's irrelevant to the accounting or the financing, because at the national level, the transfer is and has to be and always will be an actual real transfer of goods and services. So in other words, we can't put aside milk today for people to drink 20 years later. Putting aside money is a kind of accounting system that we use to try to do that. But ultimately, when I retire in 20 years, I need milk that is fresh, and somebody has to be producing it. And if I'm not producing it, then I'm consuming somebody else's labor. And so there has to be a transfer of resources, milk and health services and clothing, from people who are working to people who are not working. That is the nature of retirement. No amount of money or putting aside of money or setting up an accounting system changes that. That transfer will occur regardless of what we do, whether the government makes the transfer through Social Security or whether people make a transfer through private accounts and buying and selling on the market, or whether children, leave the workforce and take care of the parents and make the transfer that way, that it will happen. And when you add private accounts to the system, what happens is that instead of the elderly having a political claim that says that if I work and earn this much money, I get this much back, now in 40 years, when young people retire, instead of having that kind of political claim that says I have a claim on the resources of the working generation, now they'll have nothing. What they'll have is a bunch of money in a Wall Street savings account, and maybe if they sell it, they'll make enough money to live on, and maybe they won't. And what would happen is that instead of the retirement becoming a very dependable thing where people can retire without worrying about poverty, retirement is going to become a very undependable thing where some people retire with lots of money if they happen to retire when the market is good, and other people retire with nothing if they retire when the market is bad, and some people save enough and others don't. And the worst thing about private accounts, and this is something people really need to think about, is that the biggest risk of retirement is what's called longevity risk. If you outlive your savings, you're in big trouble. So if you retire with $100,000 in a private account and you only live for 5 years, that's great. But if you live for 30 years, you're in big trouble. Social Security puts that risk onto the public. We take care of the old regardless of how long they live or regardless of how frail they are. The private accounts put that risk on the individual.
So there's an interesting couple of facts that we get to point out here, so that people will be sort of armed to self-defend against an onslaught of claims. I swear we're about to see throughout the Bush administration here, because its financial backers are include Wall Street investment houses who would receive, if Social Security were privatized, the largest windfall ever for their industry, their investment
industry.
Could
I just like to say exactly how large that would be, because there's an economist at University of Chicago actually estimated this in a paper that he just put out on his website, private accounts, he stated, would increase Wall Street revenues by 25% over the next 75 years. That would be a 25% increase in the amount of money Wall Street made by managing these accounts.
If you were to try to guess, is that in the billions, trillions of dollars?
He estimated at about $1 trillion over 75 years that Wall Street would increase its revenues by.
So $1 trillion. I'd just like to try to quantify that somehow. For those of us who don't know how many zeros come after a one, which is a trillion, $1 trillion... if I'm doing it right, a million times a million, is that right? Does that come out correct?
A million times a million, so 1,000 times a billion.
a million millionaires, it's the money that they have. So far beyond, say just $1 trillion is something like around, three or four times the amount of money that the United States spends every year just on the military budget, which is a huge amount of the United States annual expenditures, $300 to $400 billion a year. Who knows if it's even higher going up in the war on terror. So gigantic amount of money.
Well, it's huge. I mean, the U.S. economy is huge too, but the financial sector is not that huge. I mean, there are a lot of money moves through Wall Street, but what actually remains in Wall Street's pockets is not that big. I mean, there aren't that many people actually work in the industry. And what this guy Goolsbee estimated is that over a 75-year period, given their current earnings and Wall Street firms would stand to make about $3 trillion, this would add a little under a trillion into their pockets. So it's a huge boon for Wall Street investment firms, because they would be the ones who are selling these accounts, not just Wall Street, but, you know, Boss Fidelity and Vanguard and these companies, a lot of them based in Boston, State Street Bank, that would be selling investment services to these private investors. It's not at all clear how it's going to work or how much fees they're going to charge or what kind of... Another thing that's very unclear is what sorts of investment choices people are going to have. And Bush talks a lot about allowing people to make choices, but in fact it's likely that people will only have the choice of one or two or possibly three investment vehicles, because otherwise the management fees will eat away at almost all the earnings.
I'm in a sick way looking forward to listening to the manipulative sales job that we're about to get, because any good capitalist business person who stands to gain something like a 25% increase, even if it were just a 3 to 5% increase in profits, would take that opportunity and would invest money in selling the proposition to the people they need to sell it to in order to get the return on that investment. So the first what sounds to me like big lie that's being advanced is that the whole system is going bust, it's going bankrupt, and we've got to do something to change it, and thank goodness Wall Street can come to the rescue. But let's look at the proposition that Social Security is not going to go bust, or with minor adjustments gradually, it won't go bust for well over 100 years. So according to the numbers that are included, cited by the President's Commission, Social Security can pay all promised benefits for the next 38 years without any changes at all. 38 years, no changes to the system.
In fact, that's based on the Social Security Administration's estimates. And the Social Security Administration, the Board of Trustees who make these estimates, are political appointees, and so they tend to be pessimistic depending on who the President is. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, which is more independent, actually said, estimated that the system is completely solvent and can pay all benefits, promised benefits, until 2052, which is another 10 years.
So totaling 48 years 48 instead years. Of just 38.
That's, right.
That's if you want to trust the Congressional Budget Office.
By which time, by the way, the baby boom will be dead. So the idea that the baby boom is the source of a problem in any way doesn't make any sense.
And then another way of looking at this is that the long-term problem faced by Social Security in the next 75 years is less than it faced in each of the decades of the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Well, the thing is that the trustees, you know, there's always been this, you know, you have to understand that when Social Security was enacted, you know, in the 1930s under Franklin Roosevelt, it was fiercely opposed by business interests because they didn't want to pay the payroll tax, number one. Number two, they were afraid that it would create an entitlement that would, you know, increase and there would be increasing pressure to raise taxes, which would raise taxes on them. And that those conservative interests have always, you know, they've never really backed down. They have been attacking Social Security constantly. There's been a lot of influence of that on the trustees' reports and how they measure it. So the trustees are constantly, you know, putting out these scenarios in which Social Security is going to go bankrupt and we're not going to be able to afford to, you know, pay anymore and we're going to have to raise payroll taxes to unacceptable levels. And they turn out to be wrong almost all the time. Social Security is, you know, the economy grows faster than Social Security usually assumes. You know, if the economy grows at 3% a year, for example, then in 50 years, people's incomes will have doubled. And so if they have to pay another 2 percentage points of their income for Social Security, so what? They won't even notice it. They'll have doubled their incomes. Their standard of living will be so much higher that will be insignificant. It will be a drop in the bucket. And so, you know, I think the really important thing to understand is that the system can't go broke. You know, as long as we're committed to taking care of our elders, we will finance Social Security. And if we teach our children that they have a commitment to take care of us, then they will support Social Security, and then it will never go broke because the commitment of the public to care for our elders will always be there. And I think that I think that ultimately there's nothing the Bush administration can do to change that.
We've talked a little bit about the potential risk in the Social Security system, a very small amount of risk. And I want to actually take a look, just to be fair, at the amount of risk which would exist in some kind of private investment system if Social Security were privatized. What would that look like? What are the kinds of risks people face when they invest money in similar kinds of investment vehicles now?
Well, there's, you know, a typical line is that the stock market, you know, people will often hear in a finance class that the stock market has returned 7% in real terms after accounting for inflation for the past 100 years, which is true over a 100-year period. But if you look at subsets of, you know, at any, you know, given year, if you invested and, you know, took money out, you get considerably less because there are all these crashes and booms. And so there's always this risk that the market will not do well. Furthermore, most people, in order to avoid that kind of risk, will probably move their investments into some kind of combined bond, money market, stock fund, which will earn significantly less than 7%. So there's the risk that you won't get very high returns on your money, in which case it won't be worth very much and it won't go as far as you had hoped. Then when you retire, there's the risk that when you cash out, the market will tumble. There's the risk that you'll outlive your savings. The biggest risk, and something which is not being talked about at all in these discussions about private accounts, is that Social Security actually protects people against inflation, which is a really amazing, something you cannot buy on the financial markets, is an annuity that protects you against inflation. You get a cost of living adjustment every year. And so all of these risks that are now, people don't have to worry about, they will now have to start having to worry about if we go to private accounts.
Ellen Frank, I'm afraid we've run out of time.
Okay.
I'm sure this issue is going to be revisiting us again and again as the Bush administration's largest campaign backers will come back again and again to promote this idea. And George Bush is nothing if not loyal to his donors and his financial supporters. So he and his administration, it's a very safe prediction to make, will try to convince you that Social Security should be privatized and managed by those responsible, conservative, careful investors on Wall Street.
But we all know what a good job they did in the late 1990s.
Tell us, what kind of a good job did they do in the 90s?
Well, for your listeners who may not know this, they might want to look at my book, The Raw Deal, which goes into some of the shenanigans of the stock market in the 1990s. The Wall Street analysts, it turned out, were taking money from we're earning huge amounts of money for bringing consulting business to the firms, and so we're cooking the giving analyst reports that were not, you know, that were biased and misleading. They were helping companies shovel money out of firms at the expense of retirement accounts. For firms like Fidelity and mutual funds were caught trading after the market, letting favored clients trade at prices that were already set at the expense of holders of retirement accounts. So we know what Wall Street has done in the past. It doesn't bode well for the future.
Ellen Frank, thank you so much for coming into the studio and for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
On Sounds of Dissent, Ellen Frank is a senior economist at the Poverty Institute at Rhode Island College. You're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM.